Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Henry Paulson said today, heck no, he did not force Bank of America to buy Merrill Lynch. The Obama administration said, heck no, we are not giving CIT a bailout. Just another day in the Great Recession, I guess. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. Online at elance.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday today, the 16th of July, and it is great, as always, to have you here. Today we saw the third and hopefully final act of the high finance soap opera that the Merrill Lynch Bank of America deal has become. To refresh the plot for you here for just a second, last December, Bank of America bought Merrill Lynch for a bargain basement price with billions in government assistance. Ever since, Congress has been trying to find out how hard former Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson and Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke squeezed Ken Lewis, the CEO of Bank of America, to make that deal happen. Lewis has previously said, and I'm paraphrasing here, yeah, they squeezed, but not too hard. Today, Paulson finally had his say.
Some have opined that I and other government officials allowed concerns about systemic risk to outweigh concerns about potential harm to Bank of America and its shareholders. That simply did not happen.
So there you have it. Paulson's got his book about the roots of the whole crisis coming out in October, by the by. From bailout to non-bailout now, the Obama administration has decided not to give CIT more government money to get by. CIT, you might remember, is the small business lender that has been teetering all week. It got more than $2 billion from the TARP last fall. That wasn't enough, though, obviously, and there is no more coming. So the bank's nearly 1 million small business customers are scrambling to find new creditors, as Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Craig Amerzian is a commercial loan broker from Surfside, California. He says even though CIT's troubles just broke into the headlines this week, the bank's been putting the brakes on lending for months.
You know, I was talking to another broker looking for hotel financing, and, you know, he mentioned CIT, but they're no longer in there. I used to go try to get gas station loans from CIT. They cut off there.
Amerzian says most of the healthy small businesses he works with have already lined up new lenders, but many of CIT's clients were struggling. For them,
The failure of CIT is going to be sort of like the straw that breaks the camel's back.
Lloyd Chapman is the founder of the American Small Business League. He knows CIT's impending collapse is unlikely to upend the financial system, but he believes hundreds of thousands of businesses will be hurt. And recently, Amerzian's seen new financial products hit the market that cater to small businesses facing a cash crunch. Some allow business people to borrow against future credit card receipts. Others take personal stock portfolios as collateral, but they typically have one thing in common.
You're talking hard money, and so you're going to be paying more in interest, and so those companies might just be bleeding you dry.
On some loans, the fees can hit 20% a month, but
a person who is self-employed, his business is one of his greatest loves, and he doesn't want to fail, and they'll do whatever they can to keep that business going. And if they have this kind of a route, then they'll tap that route, whether it's good or not. So I see that as a problem.
For some of CIT's nearly 1 million small business clients, these kinds of loans could be hard to resist. In Washington, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
Wall Street analysts usually look to FedEx and UPS as a sign of economic things to come. If they're moving more packages, the theory goes, that is seen as a promising sign. Now, though, labor specialists are paying attention to a disagreement between this country's two biggest delivery services, a disagreement on this question. Is FedEx an airline or is it a trucker? Marketplace's Dan Gretsch has more.
Congress is considering a change to labor law that would make it easier for FedEx Express drivers to unionize. FedEx currently is treated as an airline company, which is governed by the Railway Labor Act. Its industry rivals are treated as trucking companies governed by the National Labor Relations Act. The new legislation would treat FedEx Express like a trucker. Ken Hall is a vice president at the Teamsters Trucking Union, which stands to gain new members from the change.
We think it provides for a level playing field.
Rules on unionization are tougher in the airline industry since local strikes can paralyze the national transportation system. Hall says that means FedEx drivers have historically had a harder time collective bargaining as compared to UPS drivers.
UPS employees' hourly wage rates are significantly higher, plus their health insurance benefits are better and cost them less.
FedEx has said its wages and benefits are competitive with those of UPS. And a FedEx spokesman said that 85% of FedEx Express shipments are delivered by air, while 85% of UPS packages are by truck. FedEx says the legislation would tip the scales in favor of its arch rival.
Hey, it's me again, Brown Bailout Guy.
Earlier this month, FedEx started a website called Brown Bailout. The site includes a video parody that features a UPS employee searching Capitol Hill for the bailout office.
Yeah, I need a bailout.
Oh, yeah, bailout?
Because I think there's a registration office.
Government's got them and everything.
They're giving them to everybody.
The dispute has created strange bedfellows. Siding with the Teamsters in backing the proposed legislation is a collection of conservative groups, including the Frontiers of Freedom. George Landreth is the nonprofit group's president. He says the legislation appeals to some conservatives because it will encourage fair competition in the transportation industry.
So now the question is, will the law correct the accident history and treat them the same, or will it decide to treat one unfavorably and one favorably?
Landreth says he can think of few occasions over the past two decades that he's agreed with the Teamsters on anything. I'm Dan Gretsch for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, traders perked up right around lunchtime. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. J.P. Morgan Chase reported quarterly profits today. Much like Goldman Sachs earlier this week, it made a boatload of money, almost $3 billion April through June. So J.P. Morgan has clearly been doing all right for itself, but the rest of the banking sector might not be so lucky come earnings time, in large part because of all those bad mortgage-backed securities they still have weighing down their balance sheets. CNBC correspondent David Faber has a new book out about how this whole financial crisis began. It's called And Then the Roof Caved In. But I wanted to know what happens now that the cave-in has already happened. What do we do about all those toxic assets that the last time we checked are still on the books, right?
They are, a number of them. Not all of them. And it depends on the firm in terms of how aggressively they have dealt with trying to eliminate them. We have seen plenty of them change hands, where there was a buyer willing to pay 30 cents on the dollar. The key is whether there was a willing seller. So many of them do sit still squarely on the balance sheet of many of the banks that were stupid enough to have been a part of those securitizations and not have sold them completely. And there they may sit until some point in the future.
Name some names for me, David.
Well, I think Goldman Sachs has been fairly aggressive about eliminating a lot of its exposure in that area. J.P. Morgan, again, not a huge player. One of the key distinctions between J.P. Morgan and Bank America or Citigroup, for example, or Merrill Lynch, was that they did not play as heavily in the CDO arena. In other words, those securities that were made up of securitizations of mortgages. So they could be fairly aggressive. Bank of America, Citigroup, perhaps Wells Fargo, perhaps not as aggressive as some of the other firms I mentioned.
I wanted to ask you, actually, about those securities and this entire process of securitization, the bundling and selling of these mortgages to spread that risk around, which is in great measure how the entire world got affected by what happened in this economy. We had Anna Schwartz on this program a number of months ago. 93-year-old woman wrote a very famous book with Milton Friedman, as I'm sure you know, called Monetary History of the United States. She said securitization was just a loser, that we shouldn't allow it, that it only really worked for the people who were doing the securitizing. Is there a place for this buying and selling of these bonds in this economy today?
I would have to believe that there still is, that the power of securitization ultimately can be a positive one in that it creates markets and creates the ability for funding to be available in areas where it might not otherwise be. Mortgage-backed securities have been around for a very long period of time and ultimately proved to be quite a positive product in many ways by providing a great deal of money to the ultimate providers of mortgages, money that they could then use again to go out and sell more mortgages. But that being said, as so often seems to be the case on Wall Street, things become perverted beyond their original intent. And that, unfortunately, seems to have happened with securitization.
As we approach the year marker of Lehman Brothers going under, And Congress gets set at some point, I suppose, when it disposes of all its other business, to take up the issue of regulation of the financial industry. Are we coping with this crisis in a way that's going to prevent it happening again, or have we wasted the opportunity?
That, of course, is the key question that I don't think any of us are in a position to fully answer. We'll see whether the regulatory reform plans put in place or potentially going to be put in place by the Obama administration ultimately work. You know, when I look back on the crisis, I am forced to wonder whether, in fact, we would have suffered as grave a blow as many said we would if we had allowed some of these firms to ultimately fail. That's a question we'll never know the answer to. We have to take former Treasury Secretary Hank Paulson's word that it would have been Armageddon, and perhaps he was right.
David Faber, he's got a day job at CNBC. More to the point, though, he's got a book out. It's called And Then the Roof Caved In. David, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
I sort of can't believe I'm saying this, but campaign season is upon us once again. President Obama spent some time in New Jersey this afternoon. He was stumping for Governor John Corzine there. Corzine is in a tough re-election fight as the recession takes its toll on the Garden State. And obviously the economy is not going to help the incumbent. Neither, though, will what Corzine used to do for a living, help run Goldman Sachs. Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports.
Last time John Corzine ran for governor, it was 2005. Being a former Wall Street guy was kind of an asset. My, how things have changed.
Governor John S. Corzine's reputation as a supposed financial wizard is officially dead. It will take more than a recovery to get New Jersey back on track. It will take a new governor.
That's an ad from Corzine's Republican opponent, former U.S. Attorney Chris Christie. Christie's running a standard anti-incumbent, pro-tax cut campaign. Steve Adubato is a veteran political analyst and author of What Were They Thinking? He says Christie's campaign is echoing concerns a lot of New Jerseyans now have about Governor Corzine.
Hey, wait a minute. If you're that good, who cares what the economy's like? That's why we hired you, because you could get us out of this. Well, you don't have the luxury when you're a candidate for re-election to say, could you be patient with me? Doesn't work that way.
New Jersey's unemployment rate is 9.2%, far from the worst in the nation. But state residents pay the highest property taxes in the country at more than 6%. And the state is facing a budget deficit of as much as $10 billion.
You know, it's like when you live in New Jersey, our slogan should be, at least we're not California.
Adubato says Chris Christie hasn't presented much of an economic plan himself. But if things get worse between now and November, he may not have to. Voters Robert Michelena and Mary Johnson in Jersey City don't think much of Governor Corzine.
He may have come from Wall Street, but he's a classic tax and spend liberal. That's all he is.
I don't know who should be the next governor, but I'm looking for it to be somebody who can handle what's happening now.
With sentiment like that and polls that have the governor well behind Chris Christie, Corzine may be considering his Trump card, literally. There's a rumor he'll appoint as the state's first ever lieutenant governor, Randall Pinkett. Pinkett is a young African-American and winner of Donald Trump's TV show, The Apprentice. I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
Coming up, 26 miles, 1 second, and a whole lifetime.
Yeah, it changed. It was 1 second, but it changed my life. I feel like I'm somebody else, different.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials ramped up 1.1% today, 95 points, 8,711 the number. The NASDAQ also rose 1.1%, 22 points, ended at 1885. The S&P 500 added 0.8%, 8 points, wrapped up the day at 940. IBM was up 3% during regular trading and rose another 3% after the bell. Google shares traded down 1.5% ahead of its earnings report after the bell. Just an ordinary day for Amazon and Cisco. Both were up more than 1.5% today. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.57%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local services like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. Keep an eye on Marketplace wherever you go. iPhone users can listen to business news and updates on the fallout from the financial crisis. Watch the Marketplace whiteboards and follow the Scratchpad blog. Just visit marketplace.org on your iPhone.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Washington, the Commerce Department lets us know how many new homes were under construction in June. The House Financial Services Committee holds a hearing on the Obama administration's financial regulatory reform proposals. It seeks feedback from community and consumer advocates. And in the U.S., the minimum legal drinking age was set at 21, 25 years ago. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. You remember back when the government lent GM and Chrysler all those billions of dollars and got stock in return? The president promised his administration would be a hands-off owner. I don't recall any such promises from Congress, though. Today, the House is considering a bill that would force the two car makers to reopen the thousands of dealerships they've closed over the past couple of months. Commentator Dan Neal says GM in particular needs to rethink a bunch of things.
The worst idea I've heard this week is GM CFO Ray Young's suggestion that GM could start paying down the debt owed to the U.S. government with the proceeds from an IPO as soon as next year, because the capital market and shareholder expectations were so good to GM before. I have a better idea. Whatever money GM has or makes in the next decade, it needs to plow back into the company, into product R&D, engineering, battery technology. Call it radical reinvestment. Because ultimately, if GM cannot turn around its product portfolio, the taxpayers' money is toast anyway. I get it. GM wants to convey an image of a company reborn and revitalized, GM 2.0. That's why they put those fresh-faced kids Bob Lutz and Fritz Henderson out there. And the Obama administration is desperate to shed itself of these so-called government motors. The problem is GM's current products aren't that great, and the cars and trucks in the pipeline were all penciled out by the highly unreformed pre-bankruptcy GM. In other words, GM has a long shadow of mediocrity to escape. To win back old customers and entice new ones, the image challenge GM needs to overcompensate. I recommend the Lexus strategy. In 1989, Toyota's luxury division launched the spectacular LS400 sedan for about $37,000. It was obvious that Lexus was losing money on the cars, but it established the brand and created legions of fans. Today, Lexus is the best-selling luxury brand in the U.S. Like Toyota, GM needs to forget about making profit in the short run and concentrate on making great cars and trucks. Any politically driven effort to repay the U.S. Treasury early will only send GM back to the miasma of short-term, cost-cut product planning that landed them in bankruptcy in the first place. With great product, all can be forgiven, even debt.
Dan Neal writes on cars and a whole lot of other stuff for the Los Angeles Times. We would like you to write to us. Our website is marketplace.org. Click on that link that says contact. The embarrassing truth is that I slept in this morning. I just couldn't face hauling myself out of bed for a run today. Not a huge deal for me. I'm a four-day-a-week guy anyway. But for people running a marathon this fall, you sort of have to be out there even when you don't want to. The number of marathoners in this country has just about doubled over the past 20 years. Most of them will pay an entry fee and hit the road to test themselves to see if they can finish. And there are those who do it for a living. Today in our series, Working, a trip to Kenya. Kenyans, along with Ethiopians, dominate the marathoning world, and I do mean dominate. Since 1990, Kenyan men have won all but three Boston marathons. Kenyan women have won seven of the last 10. John Miller went to meet the most recent.
I think the best way to introduce you to Selina Kosgei is to play you a condensed version of the last quarter mile of the 2009 Boston Marathon.
Kara just lost the lead. Amazing.
The big story was Kara Goucher from Oregon. The last time an American won Boston was 1985. Goucher entered the stretch drive shoulder to shoulder with last year's winner, an Ethiopian named Dire Tune. everyone was focused on those two.
Dire Tune looking brilliant at this point, our defending champion from Ethiopia in the front. But Kara's coming back! Kara's coming back!
But chugging away a step or two behind was a dark, thin woman who just refused to go away.
Here comes Koskaï!
Oh my gosh, now it's Koskaï! Selina Koskaï,
the winner of the Boston Marathon.
Oh, Tune's gone. Tune collapses at the finish.
The closest finish in women's Boston Marathon history.
In a race that took more than 2.5 hours, the margin of victory was less than a second. A few weeks later, I traveled to Western Kenya to meet Selina Koskaï. That's the way you pronounce it. It turns out she's made a career of coming from behind. For years, she raced internationally as a sprinter. When she started slowing down, she switched to the 10,000 meters, but she struggled. So in her late 20s, she tried the marathon for the first time. Now she's 32. This was her first really big win.
So you know the image of there's a rainbow and there's a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow?
Yeah.
Well, you found the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. That must change your life.
Yeah, it changed. It was 1 second, but it changed my life. I feel like I'm somebody else, different.
Different and not so different.
We are going to a place where, when it is raining, we normally train there.
The worst thing a runner can do is break routine, so an hour after I got there, we went for a run. I mean, Selina went for a run. I rode alongside her in the car and asked questions.
I mean, do you get up in the morning saying, I can't wait to go out for my run today, or is it something you have to do?
It's something you have to do if you go to see this chop. You have to do it every day.
Actually, she trains 3 times a day, 3 days a week, and twice the other 4 days. Sometimes long runs, sometimes weight training, sometimes speed work. All for just 2 marathons a year. That's as many as her body can handle.
Do you love this?
Yeah, I love this.
When you train, are you in pain?
Yeah, of course. You have to be in pain.
No pain, no gain, they say.
Yeah, no pain, no gain. It's normal.
Here it's normal. This part of Kenya is thick with runners, Olympic medalists, world record holders. You can see them on the red dirt roads, running together in packs. The climate here is perfect for running, and so is the altitude, about 8,000 feet. And there are training camps now, some owned by foreigners, where runners can focus on getting better. But if you spend time here, you find that the real secret to the Kenyans' success is that they work so hard and they want it so much. Selina Koskaï grew up in a mud hut, the 10th child of a family of subsistence farmers. There was no plumbing or electricity. She got her first shoes at age 14. She knew early on that running was a way to lift herself up. Around here, the nicest houses, the biggest cars, all belong to runners.
You know, when you talk to American runners, it's about the psychology of it. It's about overcoming the difficulties. It's not about money.
But it is the same with them because they also go for money. If they don't win, they are not saying it's fun. It's something difficult. You have to work for it. Running a marathon is not running for fun. You have to be running for money.
You or I have to pay to enter a marathon. Because Selina is an elite runner, race organizers pay her an appearance fee, provided she finishes under a certain time. In Boston, her fee was $30,000. Adidas, her sponsor, pays her $30,000 a year to wear their clothes when she races. So just by doing okay, Selina can make a decent living. The big money comes when she wins. When she won Boston, she got $200,000 in prize money and bonuses. That's a big payday in a country where the average income is less than $400 a year. But Selina knows it won't last forever. She figures she's got 3 or 4 more years of running left, so she's careful about her spending. Instead of buying a trampoline, she runs in place on this old truck tire. She keeps cows and chickens to cut down on food costs. She eats what she's always eaten, cornmeal mush with small portions of meat and vegetables. She drives a second-hand Toyota RAV4 that she bought from another Boston Marathon champ. And she's holding on to her $300 a month job with the provincial prison system. She used to be a guard. Now she works in the personnel office when she's not training, which is pretty rare. Her boss, Julius Adero, says he's happy to cut her some slack. Almost all Kenyan runners have government jobs.
We are aware of what athletics has done to our country. It has put our country in the map. And it's government policy to support such international athletes to the hilt.
Selena has become something of a celebrity in Kenya. There was a parade for her when she got back from Boston. Her picture was in all the papers. Everywhere she goes, people congratulate her. But when I got there, she still hadn't been home to see her mother. So she and her husband, Barnabas Kinyor, a former world-class hurdler, drove out for a quick visit. The farm is miles from anywhere, in a rolling green patchwork of cornfields and gardens. When we arrived, we found that Selena's mother and sisters and cousins had made a huge meal for us. Selena paid for this house about 10 years ago. It's made of rough wooden boards with a tin roof. She's offered to build a better one, but her mom says she's fine with what she's got. She's just happy Selena's doing well. When we finished eating, the whole extended family gathered in the dirt yard to sing us a song of welcome. Marathons are brutal on the body and on family life. Selena's got two kids, aged 9 and 13. They live 3 hours from where she trains. So does her husband. She hardly sees them. When she quits, she says she might just go back to her job at the prison. That way the family could live together. But what she'd really like to do is open a camp for aspiring young runners to help them do what she did. Money is great, she says, but in the long run, she'd rather make history.
John Miller went to Kenya to get that story for us. Our series, Working, is a collaboration with Homelands Productions. Today was the last of the 29 profiles we have done over the past couple of years. You can hear all of them, see pictures and more on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge today. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, proof that no matter how iconic the building, a bad economy hits everybody. I read in the Washington Post today that the Watergate Hotel is set to go up for foreclosure auction next week. The hotel, of course, is part of the same complex that saw the beginning of the end of Richard Nixon's presidency. And on a related note, we learned this morning residential foreclosures jumped to a record high the first half of this year. And on that note, that is Marketplace from American Public Media this Thursday afternoon. Today, the Dow gained 95 points, 1.1%. The Nasdaq rose 22 points, also 1.1%. The S&P 500 up 8 points, 0.8%. John Buckley, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Patty Hirsch, Phyllis Owens, Betsy Streisand, and Lisa Tucker are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. Coming up next time, banks reported profits this week. Who was up, who was down, why, and why it matters. I'm Kai Rizdal. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.